Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, we're going to spend the majority of our program talking about an issue that is receiving virtually no serious consideration. Electromagnetic pulses, geomagnetic storms, and the threat to our cities and nuclear plants, energy resources, a look at our future and its sustainability, both individually and in community life and in cities. My guest in about 15 minutes now will be Matt Stein. He is an engineer with a mechanical engineering degree from MIT, and he's a National Merit Scholar. He has also probably done more really good scholarship research on this than anyone else I know in the United States. So I've set aside extra time for him, and time permitting, you'll have a chance to call in and share your thoughts and ask your questions. The latest on health and nutrition, a short commentary, not for feedback, just I thought it's a combination of several people's insights on how remarkable we are as a nation. More in-depth insight from Michael Downey from Life Extension on what we do about blood pressure. And for those of you who are drinking or know someone who is drinking, and you want to do something to help counter the negative effects of that, I'll give you that also. You've heard of Camus, C-A-M-U, the latest on that from Alex Malinsky, Natural News. Before we do any of that, a person came up to me yesterday when I was walking down the street on Broadway and said, Gary, just thought you'd know that my relative, I'm assuming this is his aunt or grandmother, is celebrating a birthday in England, and you might want to give a call out to say happy birthday to her. And I said, how old is she? She said, well, 102. I said, well, that's great. Is it now? Well, it's soon. I said, fine. So it just passed. So this is a happy birthday, slightly delayed, to Louise Rainier. She's 102 years old. Now, for those of you who know anything about film, you also know that she is the only actress to win two back-to-back Academy Awards. She worked for MGM. She did some unique films, The Great Ziegfeld and Escapade, back in 1935 and 36. But she didn't like Hollywood. She really didn't like acting that much. And so she retired just a couple years later when she was very young. And she's involved in social causes. So to the oldest living Academy Award winner, 102 years of age, Louise Rainier, nice to know that you're still there and healthy. And also you're, I'm assuming your grandson told me about your health schedule and the different products you take, and that's nice. And I'm glad that some of the things that I offer and protocols you're using. So nice to have you still with us. Now, for those who know people, as I do, even in my own family, who would drink, not to get drunk, but social drinking, because everyone did, and I would think, well, what's going on in their body? Well, at the time, I didn't know. But we would see it in the people who drank more than others. You would see the kind of the bulbous nose. You'd see that ruddy complexion, enlarged pores, broken blood vessels. But most people I grew up also smoked. So then you saw their eyes were always bloodshot. And their hair was brittled and very dry. Here's something you can do, even if you can't get them to stop smoking. Just make them a little cocktail. Let's say they're going to go out drinking. Here's what I'm suggesting that will help neutralize a lot of the effects of the alcohol, which otherwise is going to go in that body, create massive problems for your liver, your brain, your eyes, your lungs, your heart, and your kidneys. First, start with vitamin C. You have to gauge how much vitamin C a person can tolerate, but if it's buffered, I'm suggesting 1 to 2,000 milligrams. Then what is called N-acetyl L-cysteine, the letter L-cysteine, C-Y-S-T-E-I-N, T-E-I-N-E. I'm going to suggest 1,000 to 1,500 milligrams. It's great for detoxifying people. Normally, I use that to help people who have any form of liver infection, hepatitis, herpes. But it's really good for people who have any form of social drinking. Then benfitamine, about 800 milligrams. Vitamin B1, 100 milligrams. Glutathione, which is the reduced glutathione, must say reduced on it, 200 to 300 milligrams. Vitamin E as a mixed natural tocopherol, 800 units. Zinc at 20 milligrams. And then specifically to protect the hepatofunctioning, the liver functioning, chlorophyllin. Now, chlorophyllin is about 30 milligrams, and it comes from chlorophyll. So if you just want to give some chlorophyll, like a celery and cucumber juice, that would be good. If you want to add in a little spirulina, that would be good also. Then grapeseed extract, anywhere from 20 to 100 milligrams, samarium, which is milk thistle, 50 to 100 milligrams, barley grass, and resveratrol. Resveratrol, 100 milligrams, and barley grass, 1 teaspoon. So that protects the DNA from the alcohol. So for anyone who's going to drink, or anyone who has just drank, if you can get this into them, that is terrific. You can do a lot to protect their body. Now, there are a lot of superfoods out there, and more often than not, they're legitimate. They are superfoods. Now, what generally is not legitimate is when a superfood is touted as being a miracle cure for everything, and almost always behind that is a clever marketing scheme by multi-level companies that have thousands of people out there trying to get you to buy something at much higher than what you should, at generally lower doses than what it is good at. I've seen that with blue-green algae when it was the thing touted. But it was grown in a lake that was extremely polluted, and it had high bacterial counts. So I said to people, if you're going to get something, don't look at it as going to cure everything. That's irresponsible. And get it in its purest form. Almost every 6 months, we have a new superfood. The latest is called Camu, C-A-M-U. It's actually called Camu Camu. It's grown in the Peruvian rainforest. And it's in the shrub family. And what happens is it takes anywhere 5, 6, 7 years. And then it sprouts a little berry. And the little berry that comes out about 5 or 6 years is called the Camu berry. It's kind of purple. And it's about the size of a cherry. It has a tart taste. A lot of people don't like it just as eaten because it's a little bitter. But here's what it does. It's known to have a very high level of vitamin C. In fact, some say it has the highest known level of vitamin C in the world. 1 teaspoon of Camu is terrific for you. It gives you an immediate energy boost. And it has lots of bioflavonoids. It builds up the immune system. It has a full spectrum of nutrients. And virtually all the natural medicine healers in the Amazon use it because it fights off colds. It helps with herpes and other viruses. It's a great detoxifier. If someone's consumed anything that is a poison, especially young kids, they give them Camu into a beverage. So it's good at detoxifying. And it also helps if you have an upset stomach, if you have an allergic reaction to things. So it's just all around a terrific food. And so you don't take a whole lot, about a teaspoon, but it deserves its reputation for being great. Now, the biggest problem we have when it comes to heart disease is most people don't know that they have it. They don't know that their arteries are clogged. They don't know that the heart is calcified. I sat across from a man 2 nights ago who I'd never met. He was brought here by a friend that he hadn't met in 40 years. He was very robust. He was very upbeat, very positive. And he handed me at least a 2-inch-thick, 167 medical test response that he'd gotten from a major hospital. And as I'm looking at this and I'm seeing the results of the test, I'm thinking, this is serious. So I asked him, I said, what did the doctor say? Well, the doctors tell me I'm going to be dead in 6 months. And but, you know, maybe I will, but I told them I'm not going to take all their, you know, they want me on dialysis every day, and I'm not going to do that. If I'm going to die, I'm going to die the way I am and enjoy my life till it's over. He didn't know that he had calcification in his arteries and in his heart, and that most of his kidneys were gone and his heart muscle was gone. He was overweight, and his diet was an abomination. He had drank, he had smoked, he had eaten everything and anything. But I said, okay. He said, was there any chance? I said, of course there's a chance. I said, medicine has done the best they can for you. Now it's time for a different approach, natural approaches. And I gave him, I spent a couple hours with him, I gave him all that I knew that would hopefully help him. I asked him, well, is this true about your blood pressure? I've never seen blood pressure this high. He said, yeah, I never knew it was that high because I never had it checked. Well, most people don't have their blood pressure checked. That's why it's called the silent killer. Let me explain why you should have your blood pressure checked. Because if you have an elevated blood pressure, you're going to damage always the endothelial tissue. That's going to lead to atherosclerosis. You could end up with aortic aneurysm. You could end up with arterial sclerotic stenosis, or a stroke, or intracerebral hemorrhaging, or hypertension encephalopathy, or rhinopathy, or vascular dementia, or arterial fibrillation, or myocardial infarction, or heart failure, or left ventricle hypertrophy, renal failure, kidney disease. All that, when your blood pressure is elevated, and doesn't have to be highly elevated. So what can we do? Well, I won't go through everything at this moment, but I believe that according to the current medical standards, the stage 1 hypertension begins at readings of 140 over 90 mmHg or higher. I've warned on many occasions that a careful and honest review of the scientific literature shows that for every 20 over 10, you increase above 115 over 75, your risk of cardiovascular doubles. So I believe that we have far more people who are at risk of hypertension and serious destruction than what the medical community is accepting. I even believe that their overall cholesterol level is way too high. And why are so many people are considered normal at 200, 225? Because so many people have it that high when it should be down around 150. So what do we do? One thing we all can do, we can use something as simple as an olive leaf extract. You should know about the bioactive compound found in standardized olive leaf extract. It is called oleuropein, O-L-E-U-R-O-P-E-I-N. In fact, when tested on hypertensive patients in a double-blind, placebo-controlled study, it was able to reduce systolic blood pressure 11 points and the diastolic by almost 5 points. That's a big deal. That helps. So we want people to do something. Now, getting rid of salt, that's good. Taking vitamin E, that's good. Vitamin C is great. Having 3 glasses of vegetable juice a day, green vegetable juice, that will thin the blood. That's all good. Having magnesium at 1,000 milligrams and potassium at 500 milligrams, those are all good. But having the ingredients in olives or the olive leaf is also phenomenally important. Many cases of hypertension involve increased arterial stiffness, meaning just visualize your arteries as water hoses left out in the sun. First they're pliable and soft, but then later they dry out and they break and have a stiffness. That's what happens to our arteries, especially when you have meat and coffee and sugar and refined carbohydrates. So along comes the oleuropein, and it targets arterial resistance and stiffness. It improves endothelial function and bringing blood pressure under control. So that is my tip of the day, olive leaf. Olive leaf is important because I recommend olive leaf for people who have bacterial and viral infections, only 1,000 milligrams. So it's just something new. it adds into all the other things that we're doing. And of course, nothing works as well as a quality dietary and exercise change. And finally, on this issue, a lot of people look at the ads on television. They look at what's served on menus in restaurants, and they see generally fries, bagels, bread, steaks, chicken, bacon, sausages, eggs, and they think this is normal. Well, what this is not normal. It's not healthy. Why? Because of one word you should understand, arachidonic. What is arachidonic? A-R-A-C-H-I-D-O-N-I-C, arachidonic. It is an acid. And that acid comes from the egg yolk, red meat, poultry, organ meat. And that man, by the way, was eating 22 eggs a week. And it also comes from precursors. The precursor is a food that that will cause, let's say, like omega-6 fatty acids and high glycemic carbohydrates, like French fries. So you either eat something that creates arachidonic acid directly or is a precursor to it. So when you build up the arachidonic acid, that increases the production of what is called 5-lipoxygenase. Now, what's 5-LOX? That stimulates prostaglandin, and that can cause cancer cells. That can cause massive inflammation in your joints, your muscles, your eyes. That causes oxidative stress. All of this is bad for you. All of it. In interleukin B4, which is a pro-inflammatory, that's going to attack your joints, your arterial walls, your brain. That can cause amyloid plaques. That leads to dementia, brain memory loss, Alzheimer's. So when people say, "Would you, Buzz Gary, why do you want people to be on a healthy vegan diet?" It's because the biochemistry. It's not a philosophy. It's biochemistry. Get rid of the animal-based diet. Get rid of the refined carbohydrates. Inflammation goes down, and suddenly you're a healthier person. I'm Gary Nall. Now for a brief comment. These are comments from myself and Kirkpatrick Sale, who is the author of a dozen books, including Human Scale and Rebels Against the Future, who had written a book review on Morris Bergman's new book about America has failed. And I want to share this with you, Why America Failed, which is Morris Berman's new book, and we're going to have him on the program to talk about this. Because every time I turn on to watch any of the programs, see what they're handling, they're all talking about American exceptionalism. In order to maintain our exceptionalism, we have to continue our globalization and free market way, and we have to keep bailing out the banks, and we have to keep trusting the official Democrat and Republican leaders, and we have to trust the American media that they're forming the stories that we need to know about. And every time I look at this, I say, no, I don't see this as exceptional. I see it as exceptionally arrogant. I see exceptional hubris. And so I want to share some thoughts with you, just some takeaway thoughts today. And I'm going to quote Kirkpatrick Sale. He says, America has failed, and even tragically, particularly among those of the media and the intelligentsia who need to understand its truths and rid themselves of the increasingly common idea that there is some kind of a palliative that will reform and restore American government to some imagined efficient and democratic past. From the very start, from the Puritan shining city on the hill and the Jamestown settlements, conquest and exploitation of Indian lands, this country has been making and taking a business culture with a commercial orientation devoted to growth and power, wealth and property, private advancement and profit, militarism, materialism, expansion and empire. John Adams saw it at the beginning. The U.S., he was, quote, more interested than any other nation in power than ever existed. Let it be acknowledged that given this as its goal and ideal, this nation has done pretty well. It is in most terms rich and powerful, all right, full of comforts and conveniences, food and shelter and plumbing and heat for most, high-tech gadgetry and systems, a developed crumbling infrastructure, coast to coast, the largest military in the world, the world's fallback currency, an unmatched service industry, and all the rest of what makes up a modern industrial capitalist nation. But with all that concentration on hustling which makes up our entire lives, is that we have lost a sense of the public good in the face of private interest, an understanding of community in the face of aggravated individualism, a sense of spiritual well-being in the face of material pressure and stress, an appreciation of the simple life in the face of technological complexity, even a true sense of republicanism and the political commonwealth in the face of manipulative and intrusive oligarchy and political individual wealth. Much of what we still think of as some way of something to value, stability rather than progress, face-to-face instead of online, family and friends instead of networks and Facebook friends, craftsmanship instead of mass production, virtue and tradition and honor and simplicity rather than egotism and modern self-interest and multitasking. Much of that has been quite lost in the dominant hustling culture. Not only that, but we have acquired a host of evils and sorrows along with material prosperity. Berman compiles a whole raft of rather depressing facts that show what the downside of the techno-commercial society is. Mass unemployment, foreclosures, increased poverty for the many, with corporate bailouts and bonuses for the egregious few. A criminal culture with the highest rate of homicide in the world and a correction system that contains 25% of all the world's prisoners. A high incidence of violence throughout the culture, including crime, domestic violence, and warfare, along with movies, TV, and video games, a social numbness and clinically diagnosed empathy deficit disorder, consumption of two-thirds of the global market in antidepressants with at least 164 million users, a rank on the Worldwide Happy Planet Index of 150th in the world in happiness. Fully 25% of the American households had only one person, a rate of aloneness probably the highest in the world. Or, as Berman put it at one point, the culmination of a hustling, laissez-faire capitalist culture is that everything gets dumbed down, that all significant questions are ignored, and that every human activity is turned into a commodity and anything goes if it sells. What we have is domination by corporate media, politics via poll-driven sound bites, a foreign policy based on preemptive strikes, a failing newspaper industry, a poorly informed citizenry, the unemployed winding up destitute, weak mass transit systems, and a healthcare system that ranks 37th in the world. The emperor and the empire have no clothes. Berman spends a good deal of time talking about the alternative culture to all this, including a commitment to craft, community, and the public good, the natural environment, spiritual practice, and the simple life. And he shows that its adherents and champions have existed all along, though of course overwhelmed by the dominant culture. He cites examples: Henry Thoreau, Melville, Henry Adams, Veblen, Sinclair Lewis, Lloyd, Ruskin, Morris, Eric Fromm, Lewis Mumford, and on. Well, this is a distinguished bunch, and they are known today because the work they did was careful and trenchant and exposed powerfully the ills of a material society. But as Berman notes, when talking about Mumford, in the end, you can't get taken seriously if you point this out. How well I know. In conclusion, which is why in the end Berman concludes that nothing will ever change our hustling civilization and all attempts at trying to replace it are fruitless. Quote, I regard the fantasy of a recovered future as pure drivel. He sees instead that it is headed towards inevitable collapse and not too many decades away. He quotes U.S. intelligence report from Washington Post that predicts, quote, a steady decline in American dominance in the coming decades. The country eroding at an accelerated pace in political and economic and arguably cultural arenas, to which he adds, nothing can be more obvious. I'm Gary Nall. Now to my guest who is standing by. I interviewed him recently, but we did not have adequate time, so I gave a lot of extra time today to reintroduce you to Matthew Stein, an engineer with a degree in mechanical engineering from MIT and a National Merit Scholar, who has researched extensively the following question. Are the geomagnetic storms, the solar storms, the electromagnetic pulses, real, Are they going to happen? How prepared are we for that? What are some of the scenarios? If we were to have a curve that says, yeah, they'll come, but the utility companies, the federal government says not to worry. So most people will not worry. The media won't talk about it. But what if the media is wrong? What if those scientists or those engineers or those technicians or technocrats working for the utility companies are wrong? Shouldn't we know what a possibility is for worst case scenario? That's why he's back. Nice to have you back with us today, Matthew.
Oh, it's always a pleasure being on your show, Gary. Thanks a lot for having me back on.
Matthew, let's begin with the assumption some people listening right now are not familiar with the solar storms, the geomagnetic and electromagnetic pulses that are coming at us, and that we're approaching within the next 12 to 16 months a rare occasion, rare in that it comes about every 11 to 12 years, but some feel that it may be even rarer still. It could be the Carrington effect, which happened in the 1850s, where it was not just a powerful storm, but by today's standards would have virtually brought most of the world to a standstill, that part based upon needing electricity. So take us through a brief history, what these are, what science does agree upon, and then why the utilities have not moved very quickly to ensure that every major substation and station has a protective surge protector, and every nuclear power plant has a backup surge protector and enough fuel to last at least a year. So if all other electrical power stopped at a nuclear power facility, the plant wouldn't melt down and cause another Fukushima.
Okay, well, real briefly, the sun burps on a regular basis. It's called a coronal mass ejection, and it's like a burp when a big blob of stuff, highly charged sun stuff, plasma particles, gets launched at extreme velocities, like 1,000 times faster than our rockets fly. And most of the time, it flies out into space in directions away from the Earth, and it's no big deal. Well, every now and then it comes towards the Earth, and we had a pretty severe geomagnetic storm a few weeks ago, made incredible northern lights over the northern and southern hemispheres, you know, as you get close to the poles. But on the scale of things, it was bigger than most people have seen in a long time, but it was fairly small historically. Back in 1921, we had the great geomagnetic storm of 21, where it lit up the skies incredible. In the northern and southern hemisphere, in the north all the way as far south as Haiti and Hawaii, and from the south as far north as Samoa. So all but the deep tropical zones of the world were affected electromagnetically and geomagnetically. Now, in those days, there was no power grid, there was no internet, there was no nuclear power plant, so it was just kind of no big deal. It burned down a few telegraph stations. Penn Central Station burned down from induced power surges in the lines, but not that big of a deal. Life went on, you know, the world was used to getting by without electricity and internet. Well, fast forward to today, if a storm of that intensity or an even bigger one that happened in 1859, just 60 years earlier, so 90 years ago we had an extreme event, 60 years before that an even bigger extreme event, if either of those events happened today, they would fry these giant power transformers that our grid is 100% dependent upon, that didn't even get invented until around 1970. So these huge transformers, it turns out, from scientific modeling, are extremely vulnerable to geomagnetic storms along the magnitude of what happened then. In fact, we had one in 1989, roughly one-tenth as strong as a 21 storm, and it fried three of these giant transformers, two in North America and one in the UK, and it caused some problems. 9 million people lost power for 6 hours, but it was only three of these in the world that got cooked in that storm through these giant transformers. And if it happened today, you're talking 350 in the United States alone, 2,000 plus in the world, and they only make about 100-150 of these a year worldwide manufacturing capacity. So you're talking one single geomagnetic event wiping out what we've taken the last 30 years to build and taking the grid down catastrophically over most of the industrialized world. Now, as you mentioned, how does this involve nuclear power plants? Well, nuclear power plants require constant cooling to keep their cores from melting down. When you shut down a power plant, it's not like flipping a switch in the wall. You have to keep those cores cooled for 3 to 5 years after you turn the switch off. And so what happened in Fukushima, according to Japanese authorities, was not that the earthquake directly caused the meltdown and the failure of the reactors. It failed the grid immediately. The reactors went into backup mode where battery banks and backup generators kicked in to keep the pumps working, to keep the water flowing, to keep the cooling happening that keeps the cores from melting down. Well, 20 minutes later, the tsunami came along, wiped out those pumps, wiped out those backup generators and backup battery packs. Core stopped cooling. A couple hours later, catastrophic meltdown, starts dissociating the water into hydrogen and oxygen from the extreme temperatures. Hydrogen and oxygen, when they're in gas form, they become explosive. They caused explosions, breached the containment vessel, and we had a giant catastrophe on our hands. Now, we're talking, in a long-term grid-down situation, potentially 400 Fukushimas or Chernobyls all over the world going off at nearly the same time. Basically, as soon as those backup generators either A, run out of gas, or B, fail due to a geomagnetic, electromagnetic effect directly, then as soon as those failures happen from either lack of fuel or electronic failures, then you start having power plants blowing their tops and all over the world. So this is a game-over serious event. Now, the good news is that they have developed technologies to protect us from not all the bad effects of an EMP, electromagnetic pulse, or a naturally occurring geomagnetic solar storm, but against the worst effects, the game-over, game-change, end-of-the-world-as-we-know-it effects of collapsing the grid and the resultant blowing up, or not blowing up, but melting down and catastrophic failures of nuclear power plants, many, maybe not all, but many throughout the world, or probably the vast majority if it's a really bad event, like 1921 or 1859. So you ask the question, like, well, what's the chance? And, you know, why are people not worried? Well, the chance that this will happen is 100%. I mean, these geomagnetic storms, twice in the last 160 years, that's not like something that happened 50,000 years ago and might happen today like a pole shift. This is something that happens on the average of every 75 to 100 years throughout history from looking at ice core samplings. The thing is, the last time the really big one happened was 1921, before modern microelectronics, before the internet, before nuclear power plants, before a widespread grid. So we're blissfully unaware, for the most part, of this problem. Now, why hasn't the government done something about it? Well, they've been talking about it since 2008. They've been voting on a few various bills, the most recent one called the SHIELD Act, and they so far haven't passed it. They've come close, but not quite. But the industry, you say, well, why isn't the industry doing this? Well, the industry is saying, you know, we don't want to pay for this. We're a for-profit, and we think the government should do it. Now, the current SHIELD Act is putting the onus on industry to pay for these safeguards to be put in place. And so the industry lobbyists are out there lobbying, saying, ah, it's no big deal, don't worry, we don't want to pay for this. So here you have people who are basically saying it ain't that bad because we don't want to pay for it. They're not saying it ain't that bad because there's real scientific evidence saying it ain't that bad. They're just saying it ain't that bad because they've got somebody to say it isn't that bad, kind of like the global warming climate change deniers. They pay some PhDs to say it just ain't that bad. But the tests, the studies, the national studies sponsored by the Oak Ridge National Labs and independently checked by the Sandia National Labs on the Meditech study, the effect of geomagnetic storms in the U.S. power grid basically says, yeah, this problem is worse than we thought. This problem is huge. We have fixes. If we don't fix them, it's going to be just like New Orleans and Hurricane Katrina, where the engineers said, we got a problem. It's not a question of if, but when. And when that big storm hits, we're going to lose a lot of New Orleans. Well, when this big geomagnetic storm hits, we're going to lose most of the world, not just New Orleans. And
I need to go through some questions with you. If you could answer in short segments, we can get it all in, all right?
Okay, great.
Did you read the article I wrote on my website?
Yes, I did.
Is there any inaccuracies in the article?
Yes, but nothing significant. The inaccuracy was talking about the self-regeneration capabilities of nuclear, where you cited some paper. And I read that, and that was, you were citing something that really wasn't relevant. But everything relevant pertaining to the conclusion that we're going to experience massive grid failure, total failure of infrastructure, and massive nuclear meltdowns, I agree 100% with that. So when you ask the question, any inaccuracy, yeah, one minor point, but it didn't affect any of your conclusions whatsoever.
Now, I'm getting a little feedback from my engineer. I need to get this fixed in a second.
Okay.
Now, here we go. If this happens, we know the storms are going to happen. That's not in question by any scientist anywhere.
Correct.
It's how severe will it be, that's what's in question at this time, right?
Well, because it's a crapshot, you know the extreme severe storm will happen. You don't know if this solar maximum coming up around the end of 2012, beginning of 2013, is going to bring us that event like 1921 or 1859 Carrington event. That's a crapshot. But the scientists have read numerous reports where they're really worried because this solar maximum is heating up quite quickly, extremely active before the actual peak of the maximum. They're extreme concerned that we may well see an event along the lines of 1921 or 1859. Now, we just don't know if it's going to be that bad. If we're lucky, we get an in-between event that scares us silly and knocks out, you know, like 15 of these giant transformers like happened to South Africa in 2003 in a geomagnetic storm. That's a tiny fraction of the one in 1859 or 1921.
All right, but let's say that we have not the worst case, but in somewhere in between. Do we have the backup systems in place that we could go in there? And let's say we have New York City, and we have in New York State, we have several nuclear power plants, but two at Indian Point. Let's say those went down. Do we have the capacity to go in there and fix them, or any other nuclear facilities? Can we go in and fix
them? We can keep them going if we have a 2003 South Africa situation. It will be chaotic in the country. It will be extremely tough running business because the only way they could keep the country running electrically is to do rolling blackouts throughout the entire country. Imagine trying to run your business when on any given day, 6 or 7 hours out of your workday, you might be blacked out on power. And there's 100 million businesses out there who want to buy backup generators to support, to keep their businesses running when the power's down. So there's absolutely no way you're going to get a generator because you're in line with 100,000, you know, or a million other people looking for generators.
Let me give a scenario. You tell me whether or not you believe this scenario is realistic or understating or overstating the issue.
Okay.
Let's say that we have the solar storms come. Let's say they come at night, people wouldn't know it till they went to wake up in the morning and would not find that their telephone, their television, their internet, no electrical service. If they were in a building, their elevator wouldn't work. When they go downstairs, they would find that there are no traffic lights, so needless to say, under any circumstance when traffic lights are not working, you have congestion, because otherwise people have to have someone directing them of who's going to go and who's not going to go if you have all
Correct.
These people. You would find that your refrigerator and freezer would be out.
And,
but most people would probably think at that moment, okay, electric's off for some reason.
Right.
And I believe that there would be anywhere from a 6 to a 12 hour period where people would simply be asking others what's happened. And because it would be too soon for the government to send in FEMA and go up and down streets saying there's been electrical failure, please stay in your homes, conserve water and food.
Right.
I believe it would be about 12 hours before you'd start to see the first people panicking. And then you would see people rushing to the stores to empty out flashlights, candles, it depends upon whether it's winter or summer, water and food.
Right.
I then believe, I'm not quite finished, I then believe by after 12 hours, more astute people, if they have a car, will try to go someplace where they feel there may be electric working or somewhere further away if they start to see that there's problems, but then those people didn't have the full gas tank are going to say, how far can I go when I only have half a gas tank? Because
right.
there's no gas station that will be able to pump gas because it's all based upon electric. Their toilets won't work and no water out of the taps. Most people could survive without a great deal of crisis unless they're in a hospital or a setting where they're on life support and they need that, for up to 3 or 4 days by eating what food they do have, drinking what water they do have. The water will probably become their first big problem. And then I believe that within 24 hours, you'll see every road in every city congested with people trying to get out of town. All it takes is one or two cars to run out of gas or to have a wreck, and then you've got gridlock.
Right.
Now, is that realistic or unrealistic, under or overstating it?
Well, it's absolutely totally realistic, and you will have about 4 hours where your cell phone backup power will work. You have about 3 days when the regular land-based telephone lines will work on backup power, and you'll experience what Hurricane Katrina people experienced, which is cascading failure of all central services and backup services, getting worse over the next few weeks. Only unlike Hurricane Katrina, you won't have the cavalry coming in, and they were slow on Hurricane Katrina, but you're talking 100 Katrinas happening over the country at the same time, and it's just plain not getting better, and there's no place to send the cavalry in. And in a recent tabletop EMP solar flare exercise done at the at a big defense institute in Washington, D.C., the people who were participating, and these are first responders and military guys, top-notch people in that field, the people who are supposed to know what to do, it became quite clear to them they'd be totally overloaded, and most of them would abandon their posts and go home to help deal with their family and cope and protect their family to the best of their ability. Total chaos, total breakdown of all systems, and if you think that they're under that situation, that the government will make good on its promise to make sure that diesel trucks show up at nuclear power plants consistently to keep them operating for the next year in their cooling systems, I think that's a hopeless fantasy.
But how are they going to get to a power plant when the roads are going to be bumper to bumper with nothing moving? That's not going to be possible.
Well, plus if they have a moving diesel truck, we're a very well-armed society. The chances that that diesel truck would actually it past roving bandits who say, you know, diesel is black gold, as well as food. Food and diesel will be black gold. And one thing you didn't mention is when you go to the store, you won't be able to buy anything. So if you're not planning on stealing in the store, you're SOL. You're totally out of luck. So you have to plan on either using what you've got or becoming one of the roving bands of thugs and stealing what you need, because there will be no way to buy anything.
Okay, now, just hold your thoughts for a few moments while I share a few things I believe we should consider. I know I have, and my people I know, we've already set up a scenario. Let me share this with others because you may find something of value in it. The time to buy the fire extinguisher is before the fire, not after.
Correct.
And so what I suggest, if you have a car or if you know someone who has a car, reasonably, without rushing, without panic, meet and say, where can we go? And I have a whole page of nuclear power plants around the United States. I prepared that for my film, Knock on the Devil's Door. I wouldn't want to be near a nuclear power plant. Secondly, where would be the most likely place to survive? Well, it depends. Some people say go north. Other people say go west. Other people say go south. Based upon the time of year that this happens, and there's no way of predicting that.
Correct.
I wouldn't want to be in the north when there could be blizzards and cold and snow if there is no heat. And I wouldn't, and I want to be where there at least is a capacity not only to get to a place, but to sustain a life afterward. I know that not every place will be equally adversely affected. So what I've done is gotten people who are going to, they know that you've got 6 hours, and hour six we start leaving the city, no
right.
matter what. And then
right.
you keep one person behind for hour seven, hour eight, hour nine, hour ten. But by hour 12, everyone in that particular procession is gone. You have in advance a backpack, and in that backpack you put your valuables. You put what you need to survive. You put a radiation suit, which is very inexpensive and small, and a radiation mask, and with cartridges that last about 8 hours each, and boots and gloves. The whole thing might cost you about $150. A backup bicycle, fold-up bike. Why? Because if you have no other way of getting someplace, ride a bike.
Right.
And then have a backup water, food, and a water filter, so at least where if you get to some place, you at least can have some safety in drinking water, so not against radiation, but against other microorganisms cause problems. If you have already at a place that you've decided will be your destination, in advance, have it stored in a way that you and you or the people alone know it's there. Backup dry food supplies so that when you get there, you have a year or 2 years worth of backup food. And so that's what I'm suggesting. I'm suggesting people know in advance where they want to go, have people they can work with that they can go along, and have a time that wherever you're at. I told, you know, we have a group of people. One says, well, I'm out on Long Island. If I'm working in the city, what do I do? Well, have a backpack in the city and a bike in the city. Have everything, because if you think you're going to be able, when the electricity goes out, to get out to Long Island, get what you need and get back, you're going to be alone. Then you're going to have to bike it. I believe that you'll have 12 to 14 hours to get out of the city maximum, though I believe 6 hours is when ideally. People are still looking for information. No one's really panicked at that point. They may be angry or start walking back from work.
Right. And look, they won't have figured it out by that time, in general.
But at least you're getting out and you're getting, I believe people should be going south or southwest at this point, not north, because there's an awful lot of nuclear facilities north. People are not even aware of it.
Well, there is backup fuel. So it depends. The nuclear issue will be, it depends. See, an EMP, which is electromagnetic pulse, from a terrorist nuclear event where they blew something off, say, 20 to 150 miles above the planet, and it causes this pulse. And the EMP is different from the solar event because the EMP has a very short two effects, E1, E2, and E3, where solar event is a very kind of long, slow burn that mostly fries the grid. But the EMP E1 effect is like nanoseconds. It's like speed of light, and that fries a lot of electronic chips. And especially in the complex digital systems that control our nuclear power plants, our industrial processes, basically our communication systems, all the stuff that makes our world go around, anything that has long runs of Ethernet cable connecting digital controls, that cable acts like an antenna and picks up the E1 pulse and fries the digital electronics. So your home stuff will probably be okay, but the industrial stuff that makes our world run around will be mostly cooked. So in a solar event, you don't have to worry about the nuclear thing happening right away. It's like set your watch, and you know, 1 week later, depending. Some plants have a month of fuel on hand. They're only required to have a week on hand. So you've got time on the nuclear event, but the infrastructure will be down. The gasoline will be down. The things will be degrading like they did in Katrina day after day after day, steadily worse. So the sooner you figure things out and bug out of town, the better. Now, I just want to mention that my latest book, When Disaster Strikes, A Comprehensive Guide for Emergency Planning and Crisis Survival, is like the perfect handbook to help you plan this stuff and to put in your go bag, to bring with you. It's got a built-in survival guide, a built-in emergency medicine guide, a built-in first aid guide, and it also goes over all of the emergency prep things and things you need to have together. So that's my quick pitch for that. But it's in an, and it has a chapter on surviving the unthinkable nuclear catastrophes, as well as a chapter on EMP and solar storms. So it'll really help you educate, and it's well organized to guide you step by step through these processes.
Well,
and not everybody can afford the out-of-town place to go.
I understand, but look, in any circumstance, not everyone's going to survive. You can't help every single person caught in a catastrophe survive. I wish we could. You can't. I'm just giving as much information. I believe the church group should be meeting and discussing this so that they can have some preparation among their church and synagogue and mosque family so they can help those who otherwise wouldn't be able to help themselves. I believe if you can force the government government to put backup generators in all these places? They should have all these backup generators in place. That's something we can do and demand now.
That's correct.
All right.
That's correct.
I also believe that if you have a home, you can put a backup generator, but I suggest propane gas, not diesel, because diesel, you have to fill it up every about 6 hours, where propane, you could put a year's worth of propane in the ground, so at least you have it. I believe you should have you should have backup gasoline in 55-gallon drums. There's a lot you can do for you and your family and friends, so at least those you can help, you know, having a backup generator means your water will still keep going, so you'll have water out of your well.
So if you got a well,
if you got a well,
but well water, yes.
Yeah, so there's a lot that we can do.
Oh yeah, there's a huge amount.
You know, but I'm also concerned that society will see the ugly side of what it's denied. You'll have massive gangs, you'll have massive robberies, you'll have massive looting, and unfortunately, law enforcement is going to be taking care of its own in most cases.
That's correct.
Especially as they got wind that, gee whiz, in a week from now it's going to get really bad. We can have, you know, a nuclear... When word gets out there's going to be a nuclear explosion, you'll just have people running out of the city.
Oh, yeah. When they hear that Indian Point is running out of fuel and there's no fuel coming and that New York City is going to be uninhabitable for generations... And that, you know, 37% of Americans, more than one out of three, live within 50 miles of a nuclear plant because they build these plants not in the cities but near, because they don't want to lose all that energy by transmitting it long distances. So all the major, highly densely populated parts of the country have nuke plants nearby.
Well, what I'll do, you're out in Truckee, California.
That's correct.
Okay, if you were in New York, if you're going to be in New York soon, in the next month, when I have a full schedule, but I'm going to set aside an afternoon. I've done this once to explain to people the best places to go and what they should do to try to form small groups of people they're familiar with and people that they can help, because if someone doesn't have any car or transportation but someone else does, you share, you cooperate, you
right.
care for one another. And
it's a village.
Yeah,
it's a village to survive.
But right? I'm saying start thinking about the village now, but not when it comes crunch time, and then you have little resources left. If you start planning now with about a year ahead, I think most people who want to could do something to get out of harm's way. I already know people based upon who came to my last workshop. There's a couple I know who have an apartment in another state that's safe, that doesn't have any nuclear round, and they did exactly all the things I suggest. They have 2 years worth of food stored. They have their valuables there. No one knows where it's at. They know how to get there, and they're going to
right.
do that. All right, and
right.
they're going to take the people in their lives that they can help. So everybody can help somebody. You know, it's
That's
like
correct.
Help somebody, but not everyone is going to be able to be helped. And we would hope that at that point our government would help those who wouldn't otherwise be helped. But we know what they did in Katrina.
Right.
Let's do this. When you're able to come to the East Coast, let me know, and I'll plan on. We'll have a double program. We'll both offer in our insights, because I'm talking also, I'm already creating an article about how people can create communities in safe areas that are least likely to be adversely affected, and where there's a greater opportunity to survive the future with quality of life.
Well, and that sounds terrific. You know, I don't get to the East Coast very often, but when I do, I'll be sure to coordinate well ahead so we can
coordinate
do something together.
And we'll put this. We have time. I don't want anyone panicking. Now, I'm just saying that let's say that Matthew Stein, the engineer, and myself are wrong. That there are solar storms, but there's no big problem. Well, what is the downside of having prepared for it? All right. So if I go out of town and I'm 1,000 miles away and suddenly they get all the electricity on and everything's fine, I can turn around and come back.
That's right. But maybe you miss a day of work and
yeah,
your radio show is missed and you say, oh, Gary, I don't know where Gary is, you know, whatever.
But what if we're right and we're 1,000 miles away and prepared and have a group and then we made the right choice? And I'd rather be on the right side of this issue than the wrong side. And Matthew, give us your website, please.
A website is whentechfails.com, for When Technology Fails, my first book. And there's really terrific free articles. If you just click on articles, great information, grab-and-go kits, purifying water, surviving the next superbug, a lot of really good practical information. It gives you a taste of what's in my books.
Yeah, I've seen it, and I certainly think you've done an exemplary job of helping prepare people. Thanks a lot, Matthew. Nice to have you with us.
You're welcome, Gary. Always a pleasure. Have a great day.
Bye. And when he does come to the East Coast, I'll coordinate our schedule so we can do a whole day for anyone who's interested, and we'll even have it internet connected, so in case you're not in the immediate vicinity, you can be there. And I believe that we could have millions of people, literally, by that time, knowing what to do and have a plan A and a plan B. Always have two plans. One, if you can do it with people, one, if you have to do it alone. I have a plan that if everything fails, okay, what do I need to do? Am I ready for that? And the answer is yes. And I'm going to help other people, as many people as possible, do the same. Now, I'm going to take a couple calls now at 888-874-4888 on this subject before we finish here. Let me also mention, we are sold out, finished, with our premiere of the American Veterans film coming up in a couple weeks. However, I will be with two films premiering, the American Veterans film at the Huntington Arts Cinema and Death by Medicine. The American Veterans film will be from 12 to 2:15 and Death by Medicine 3:15 to 5 o'clock. There'll be a reception for an hour afterwards. There'll be Q&A. And you can call the Huntington Arts Cinema if you'd like to join me on next Sunday. That's how quick it is, jumping up at us, next Sunday. And not every one of the six premieres I've done there have been packed. So if you want advance ticket, call 800-838-3006. 800-838-3006. I'm going to premiere my brand new feature film, a powerful film. And it's a whole, and I'm bringing in some of the vets that you're going to see in the film. Doug Rokey's coming in from Minnesota. I'm going to show what's happened to our American veterans, that Gulf War syndrome, how many are sick, how many are homeless, and what we can do to help them. This is about raising our conscience to help the men and women who are suffering terribly now. That'll be next Sunday, the 4th, and I'll be a double feature. It'll be at the Huntington Arts Cinema in Huntington, Long Island, and it'll be at noon. I'll be there, as will the vets, to premiere our American veterans, Abandoned and Betrayed. And then there'll be a Q&A afterwards. And then at 3:15, premiering Death by Medicine. And I'm going to give gift copies of both films to everyone who attends. So then that's it. That's the only premiere outside of the one downtown. So 800-838-3006. I look forward to seeing a lot of you there. In studio, we're going to take some calls now. We have Myron. Hi, Myron.
Hi, Gary. How are you?
Good.
Good to hear. We have a couple of exciting new announcements I just wanted to make regarding the accessibility of our radio stream.
Yeah.
As part of our efforts to make it as easy as possible to listen on the go wherever you are, we're proud to announce new iPhone and BlackBerry streams. If you're one of the tens of millions with one of these smartphones, simply open your browser and navigate to www.radiotuner.mobi, /PRN. So that's radiotuner.mobi/PRN, and you can listen right on your smartphone. And if you have a dumb phone, or if you don't have a smartphone, you can just call in from a landline or your cell phone to listen live anytime, 832-280-0066.
Again?
That's 832-280-0066.
Gino from New York, your turn, you're on. Gino?
Very informative, very stimulating, very cautionary show today. I'm just giving a reminder that perhaps we can do a march again to remind the governor and so on that he is against the plant, but at least to have these backup systems in place. So along with the information, we can do some action with it. And also that I heard that you have a desire to do a DVD on Edgar Casey. I'm really excited about that also.
I'm working on the Edgar Casey documentary as we speak. All right.
Yeah, when I see you at the Gulf War veterans and the homeless veterans film in a few weeks, I know a couple of people who are still alive. One is 93 who knew him very well, so I'd like to give you some contact information for her.
Thank you. I'd look forward to that. Thank you, Gina.
Okay.
Paul from New Jersey. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Gary. How you doing? I always enjoy listening to your show at my lunchtime.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And I had a question and some information. One question was I wanted to ask, I guess, Matthew, is with natural gas, I'm going to be getting a generator very shortly. I can handle natural gas, propane, and gasoline.
Mm-hmm.
And with natural gas, if the power is out, the pipelines, do they rely on electricity?
They didn't used to, but most of them do now. The booster pumps used to be powered by gas. To compress the gas, and now they're powered by electricity. So unless your local system still use the older style pumps, then natural gas will go down when the grid goes down.
Wow. How about a quick fix, maybe some solar panels around those main pumps? You think that would be good enough to take care of that?
Oh. Well, you know, it's easy. The old style pumps and technologies worked for many, many decades using gas to pump to power and compress the gas. So yeah, I would suggest they went back to that because, you know, if you had a cloudy day or extended storm or no wind or something like that, then, you know, it's like if you're relying on a supply of gas getting somewhere, then and you've got a supply of gas readily there, might as well use it to pump it.
Well, what I'll do, we're out of time now, but on Monday's show, I will open this discussion up again for those of you who are not able to get through, because there are ways that you could have a year's worth of propane in the ground, I know this for a fact, and have solar as a backup. But we'll go through this on Mondays. We'll continue to answer your questions that you have, and our whole lines are all lit up here. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more in the next program. Now, Danny Schachter.